Vikas, is there a got it on the screen? Hello?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Welcome, everyone. I will go around and greet people on Zoom, and then those of us in the Zendo will introduce ourselves. I'll start with Jinryu. Betty. Yeshe Tsoki. Bob. Paulette. Tyler, Karen, Marv, Gathel, Shoketsu, Joshua, Ellen, Alice, Katie, welcome back, Coral, and Carson, Sabrina, Ruth Ann, and Zendo.
Franklin.
Drew. Dennis. Andrew.
Erica.
Vikas.
Ted.
And Domio.
Just if I may jump in for a second, you sound a little far away. Perhaps I'm the only one.
I just turned up the volume of the microphone a little bit. Does that sound any better?
You sound fine to me.
I mean, the microphone's not on the ideal setting, but that's because we want it to be two-way when somebody comes up to ask a question. How does, Bob, how do you think it sounds? All right, good enough, I guess.
Sounds okay.
Okay. All right. Let's see. In terms of announcements, we have another one-day retreat coming up this Saturday. So please think about joining us for all or part of the day. It can be online. It can be in person. It's lovely if you're going to be here in person, if you register, just so that I know. And even if you're going to be online, too, it's kind of nice to know who's going to be participating with us. And also, I need to plan for the work period to have enough for all of you to do. Then on Sunday, we have our annual Vaisak ceremony, the festival of the Buddha's birth. And that will be in place of our usual chanting service. So our usual chanting service is at 9:30 Pacific time, and we will start that ceremony at 9:30. So if you want to come a little early and help, if you have some flowers, you want to help decorate the bower. Jinri, do we still need a couple more volunteers?
We could have just one more, and we do need people to bring flowers.
Okay, so if you are coming in person, bring flowers. I mean, ones from nature are great. So we could use one more person. And you could email me or let me know if you're interested.
I'm coming as well. I'm bringing
you. So right now we have Shoketsu and Yeshe Tsoki, which is great. Another person would ensure that we are done in 30 minutes. And if you are going to bring flowers and help decorate, it would be great if you could be there at 8:45.
All right. And Alice, you and I are going to be setting up special camera work to show the fancy altar to the Zoom people. So we have extra Zoom tech work to do on Sunday. All right. I think that's it. Except that if you are curious about what I did last weekend in West Virginia, I have posted updates about that on Facebook, particularly on for my new podcast, Climate and You, I have a Climate and You Facebook page. And so I kept people up to date about what I was doing. And also, I plan to do probably this week's podcast episode about my experience. So if you're curious about that, check in with that. All right. So tonight, you get me as a class leader. It was going to be Pat Almond, but she had a family emergency, or somebody she's helping go to a surgery, and that got rescheduled, so she wasn't able to do this, which is a bummer, because I feel like, I don't know, that's part of the fun of the precept study, is just, you know, hearing from different people. And but here we go. I'll do our class on Do Not Misuse Sexuality. And I also love the classes being led by other people, because, you know, they just go in a different direction with the precept than I would tend to go. My mind tends to go more or less the same way most of the time when I address the same topic. So if you have heard me present a precept class on this, which hasn't been, it's been about 5 years, I think, since I have done this, but I apologize if it seems familiar. All right, so I did not refer to the text we're all reading. I have my own favorite text, which I will share with you. So do not misuse sexuality, remain faithful in relationships. Oh, and let's see. If you'd give me just a moment here, I'm going to zone out. I want to share screen and have us do a, you know, a brainstormed list at some point, but I was too distracted and I didn't get myself set up in time to pull it up. So let me see what I can do here. I think it'll be okay. Let's see. All right, just coming up. I'll be able to share that at the opportune moment. We can do a communal brainstorm. Okay. So the full verse from our Kyoju Kaimon, the first sentence being from Bodhidharma, in the realm of the ungilded Dharma, not coveting or creating a veneer of attachment is the precept of not misusing sexuality. The three wheels are pure and clear. When there is nothing to desire, we follow the way of all Buddhas. So what do we mean by sexuality? We mean, of course, sex, like physical sexual intercourse, etc., but plus all the emotional, behavioral, cultural stuff that goes along with all of this. And so my favorite text on this is Being Sexual and Celibate by Keith Clark, who's a Capuchin monk. And I did look it up. You can get used copies of it, but it is way out of print. So it's this incredibly sweet, insightful book about just intimacy and sexuality. And yeah, so I'm going to share some of that with you. He says, so, you know, sexuality in a sense is just as big a part of a life, part of the life of a celibate as any of us. It's still part of who you are as a human being and how you deal with that energy, how you relate to that energy, what it has to do with your human relationships is a big part of your life. So he had reflected on it a lot. And he says, I now regard my human sexuality as all those activities which stem from or lead to the gratification of my biological urges and emotional drives, and which stem from and lead to the fulfillment of my personal need for intimacy. Those activities which stem from and lead to the fulfillment of my personal needs for intimacy, I regard as the specifically human aspects of my sexuality. Sexuality is a much more pervasive reality in human life than most people I have spoken with seem to believe. Having taken considerable time to reflect rather seriously on our experiences has led me and some close friends to suspect that our sexuality is much more pervasive of our lives than we first imagined. Dr. Sigmund Freud showed the pervasive nature of our sexual urges and drives. I am not thinking of those biological and biopsychological aspects of human sexuality when I tell myself that human sexuality is more pervasive than most people appreciate. I am referring to the pervasive influence of that in human sexuality which makes it specifically human, our need for intimacy. The insistence of this need for fulfillment and the havoc wreaked when it is not met explains to me much of human interaction. It also explains most of the frustration with life experienced so deeply, even by those who are happily married or sincerely devoted to the service of others through a celibate lifestyle, by those who are dedicated to the single life, by swingers, by single parents who cope well, or by those who are widowed and have to adjust to a new life. Much of the disappointment in the lives of celibate and married people, as well as in the lives of all others, comes from failure to recognize the personal need for intimacy and from relying exclusively on the gratification of our biological sexual urges and our emotional or biopsychological sexual drives to bring happiness into our lives. A fuller understanding of our sexuality, one which recognizes our need for intimacy and helps us meet that need, can bring a great deal of happiness to lives which otherwise might be merely surfeited with pleasure or filled with disappointment. So I see this as, I'm not no great scholar, philosopher on human sexuality, but it strikes me as very significant that there's a koan of the existence of an individual. An individual is by nature separate. And there's part of us that's always kind of being pulled, seeking to become connected again, to have a sense of belonging, to have a sense of being recognized. And I know that for many of us, this intensity of intimacy is at least often first experienced in a sexual encounter or a sexual relationship or romantic relationship, and then sometimes periodically experienced as we, become infatuated with somebody or fall in love with somebody, and there's this sense of non-separation that we taste through this kind of connection, which is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. But essentially what we're getting to with all the precepts is, this is a domain where if you enter it with selfishness and self-centeredness, problems are created. So you might find it kind of interesting that a celibate would be insightful, have write a whole book about sexuality. But I understand it because I myself I needed to be celibate for a year before and then 5 years after ordination. There are Zen priests who are married that get ordained. It's very wide divergence in the West. But my teachers in particular did not want, if you were single, you needed to stay single. If you were in a relationship, you needed to stay in that relationship. And if either of those things changed during your initial 5 years of training, you needed to take the robes off and step away and take care of that, because that's a very, you know, it's a turbulent thing. It takes a lot of, whether it's excitement or devastation or whatever, it was just not, you couldn't be paying full attention to your monastic training while doing that at the same time. So I was single, and so I had to not be involved with anybody. But I thought about sexuality and relationships a lot during that 6 years, a whole lot. Frankly, there was always somebody that I was obsessed with, very quietly, silently, not doing anything about it. But it was interesting to just watch. This is the value of literal renunciation sometimes, is we just have to watch our own bodies and minds without acting it out, and therefore, you know, it complicates things. It's not just us involved anymore, but we have to watch the whole thing play out within our own body and minds. So I watched myself grasping for these different relationships. I mean, for me, and this is still the case, a primary romantic relationship is like, I don't, it's one of the central points of my life, one of the greatest joys of my life, one of the pillars of my life, except for that period when I was in Zen training. I was married before that. I got divorced. I got married right after that. So, and my parents are happily married for 50 plus years now. And that is like one of my greatest sources of joy. But I noticed when I needed to do without this, my obsession is a strong word, my preoccupation with it. And I had to watch and in a way even ask myself, what if I never had that again? What would that mean? And for many people, I think this is, even if you're in a relationship, sometimes the relationship is really not meeting that need, that need for intimacy that Clark is talking about. And that can be almost as, perhaps even more painful than being single and not having a relationship. So I really had to explore what did I want out of that? What did it give me? And, you know, what would it mean to be happy by myself? And it was really, I mean, it wasn't any one time, but over the course of that training, I really came to a point where I recognized I did not need a relationship anymore. That I was okay, that it was, that I guess it was that affirmation that we get from being seen, from being touched and connected and loved, which is so wonderful. But I recognize that, you know, that is simply a that reflects what is true. I don't have to have that affirmed from the outside to be able to rest in the truth of that. In which case, I realized that now I'm in a place where if I do go into a relationship again, which I did, it'd be in a different way. It wouldn't be in a way like I have to I have to have this, and I have to have you, and I have to have you you know, love and adore me in a particular way, it would be, I guess, more open-handed. So one of the things that Clark talks about, I think is interesting, is, you know, I don't know if you find this interesting or not, but, you know, really that, what is that energy of attraction that brings us together? And I think about how, animals, particularly animals that at least for a season are form a pair bond, are monogamous, they have ways of interacting with one another that get past what would ordinarily be an aggressive or defensive response. You know, there's a particular courtship dance you do, bring offerings, then you like do mutual grooming is something that birds do, it's something that mammals do, you know, picking the little. And these things are, they overcome what is our natural, frankly, it's our natural aversion to one another. You know, it's like we're annoyed by one another, we want to protect our stuff from one another, there's a lot of aspects of ourselves which are like, you know, the opposite of this kind of, oh, I feel this love and connection. So it's interesting that we have this powerful draw, which of course, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't survive as a species, we wouldn't have a society, you know, etc. So this is a powerful, important energy that we have. But do not miss, so I even wanted to kind of perhaps rephrase this, and it probably loses something, but rephrase the precept, do not misuse the energy of attraction. Remain faithful in relationships. You know, there's something missing from that, but it also, unlike the word sexuality, it broadens it a little bit. Sexuality, it seems, often we often think of that in a very limited way. So this includes, of course, sexual attraction, physical sexual interactions, romantic relationships, but also the other important relationships in your life, parents, children, spouses, siblings, close friends, and your longing for closeness, disappointment when it's not there. So in that Bodhidharma's phrase, he says, in the realm of the ungilded Dharma, not coveting or creating a veneer of attachment is the precept of not misusing sexuality. So to covet, yearn to possess or have something. One of the dictionary definitions is to desire wrongfully, inordinately, or without due regard to the rights of others. So inordinately is immoderately or excessively. So desire something excessively, particularly without due regard to the rights of others. Synonyms are crave, envy, lust after, begrudge, and thirst for. So this might be a relationship with a person that we don't, you know, we don't yet have that relationship, or we can't have that relationship, or maybe it's a relationship we do have, but we want to possess someone. Envy, jealousy, control, lack of boundaries. And then there's this creating a veneer of attachment. So veneer, an attractive appearance that covers or disguises the kind of the true nature of something or something, someone. And one definition, a superficial or deceptively attractive appearance, display, or effect. So the deceptively attractive appearance, you know? It's like, because it's like you've got this, most furniture you buy these days, like, oh, that looks so nice. And then the first time you scratch it, you realize it's just like, you know, pressed wood underneath. A facade, a mask, a guise. So there's probably many ways that we could interpret this, but I thought about, you know, how we might enact, even make ourselves believe that what is going on in a situation is real love and regard, when we really just, we just want something out of this situation. We want sexual gratification from this person, or we want someone's adoration or affirmation, or we want something out of this relationship. And, you know, we create that veneer of attachment to make it seem like we're being motivated by love and whatever. So, as I said, breaking any of the precepts is basically about selfishness or self-centeredness. Just like do not kill, we do violence, or we steal, or we take more than our fair share, or we lie, or we compare ourselves to others. You know, all these different domains where, like, you know, the self-motivated, the small self is going to take it, or, you know, cut things off or feel threatened. So using the energy of sexuality or attraction selfishly. So this is where I thought we could brainstorm ways people do this. So let me see if I can, we'll share my screen, and then I'll have to get Zoom folks lined up so I can see you a little bit. And hopefully those in the Zendo will be able to see this. It won't be too tiny. That looks okay up there. All right. And let me make the Zoom panel a little bigger so I can see a few more people. All right, so in this case now, if you are on Zoom and you want to offer something, then you need to raise your hand using the reactions button or just unmute yourself, because I can't see everybody, so I won't be able to see if you're raising your hand. And those in the Zendo are welcome to chime in as well. Ways people conduct themselves selfishly or self-centeredly in the domain of human intimacy. What was that?
Result over experience, like the end result of it is more important than the experience of it.
The experience of the interaction.
I guess what I have in mind here in particular is
would you come up? Yeah, come up and sit on this chair so that we can hear you a little bit. The Zoom can hear you.
What I said was result over experience. What I had in mind was maybe there's, I guess I'm thinking specifically of like a sexual experience. Maybe the focus is on orgasm. Maybe it's yours or your partner's, but that's kind of a self-centeredness. And really, like the intimate thing is to be present with that experience, mm-hmm. and just however it ends is however it ends, right?
Sure. And I could see that also being like, I don't know if you were thinking of this, but like a conquest as well. Like, yeah, I slept with that person, or.
That would count.
Katie, and then Alice.
Well, I just, you know, being unconscious about power dynamics. So not realizing that or not caring that you might be, you know, you might be a higher status person in a workplace and you're not paying attention to those things.
So basically ignoring power dynamics for your own.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
Pleasure or purpose. Alice.
Yeah, I think the power thing is a good point. Like using sexuality as like a bargaining chip or, but what I wanted to say at first was hiding your marital status or your partner status in front of someone just for the sake of self-gratification.
Just add to what Alice said, not being respectful of other people's relationship status or marital status.
And that leads me to one I was thinking about, which is, I mean, there's this thing that in a way, There's certain settings in which flirtation is like fine, no big deal, right? But there is like when there are other relationships involved and you're starting to kind of step on the edges and jeopardize that a little bit, but essentially the experience of flirtation is like exactly like self-gratification of or affirming of your ego that somebody's, you know, interested in you. So I'll say flirting carelessly. Tracy.
Staying in an unfulfilling, non-functional relationship for fear of change.
And fear, like we were saying, of that loss of the intimacy and connection that you have or had, or maybe this is the only way that you're going to get that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I have more of a question than anything else. When you were quoting the book, I was thinking about sexuality as kind of being a proxy, maybe a weak proxy for intimacy.
Mm.
And it got me thinking about, okay, we generally recognize that out of, let's say you're married, or you don't have to be married, but you're in a committed relationship with somebody. And if you go outside that, and apparently, you know, but if it's not within the bounds of the agreement of the relationship, then you're unfaithful, and you know this sort of fits into the standard idea of what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
But then it got me thinking about, okay, well, let's just talk about intimacy then. Is it, what's the relationship? It's, we don't have the same feeling about intimacy necessarily with someone else if mm-hmm. we're just being, say, I don't know, it's not sure how to phrase this, but
a non-sexual intimacy with another person is something that I think we might get in a friendship, for example. So I don't know what my question is, but I'm trying to make this distinction or trying to make this
it's interesting because you make me think about this. I heard it described. You could stay there if you want to continue the conversation. Well, you made me think about, I can't remember where I heard it, but that if you were going to define, you know, unfaithfulness or cheating, that it would be like, it's like a part of yourself gets walled off just for that person. And so I think that's, I don't know how to phrase it very well, but there's something about kind of openness. If it's a very open, there's like nothing's being hidden, nothing's being just specially saved for this, even if it's a non-sexual friend, right? Willfully. I mean, we act differently with different people, but there's no like, I'm taking something from our relationship and I'm going to, you know, put it over here only for this person now. Which that's what it seems like at a more subtle level gets at, which I think that's, you know, that's the theory behind, you know, polyamory and stuff like that, where this is talk about open, honest, consensual, like I'm not sneaking off and essentially stealing something from our relationship in order to, you know, get this self-gratification. But it's an interesting question.
Yeah. I guess my comment has to do with the gray area of what you just kind of mentioned, Franklin, but once again, it seems like both intention and the overall purpose of the precepts, which is to minimize suffering, seems to come into play. Mm. So as an example, it would be like emotional intimacy, if like the intention of that was to console like a friend who's going through a hard time is one thing, but if there's a sort of ego behind the intention, right? Like if that's going to lead to, you know, leading a person on emotionally, even though this is just for your, I guess, gratification. And then like, you know, you're never going to be with that person. This is just for like, you're having fun. You're, you know, what's the phrase? You're flirting carelessly, right? For example, I guess that, I don't know, it seems to come back to that. There's like minimizing suffering and like, what's the intention behind it? I guess the context is kind of everything. Yeah. I don't know.
I at one point in my, I wasn't ordained yet, but I was moving toward it. And I ended up having a brief dalliance with a former partner. It was after my first marriage, and my teacher basically told me that as long as I wanted to be on this path, for me anyway, this precept meant no sex out of committed relationships. And that was not like how I lived in college. That was, I'm like, God, that's square. That is just, I mean, come on, two consensual adults, you're not in a relationship, you know. But, and I don't necessarily agree with her, but what I think, because, once again, because I had to kind of toe this line and kind of explore it in a different way, I think I saw the wisdom of that rule, even if it's not something that you follow completely, because I had this like, basically playing with human sexuality is playing with fire. like you may think, who cares, but like it is an extremely potent energy, and you know, yes, occasionally it can be just done, you know, lightly and you get away with it, but a lot of times no. So there's that care that we want to take. And I thought also of you know, getting into a relationship of some kind with someone, and you know, if you don't really care that much about them, or maybe, you know, you care, but you're not in love with them, whatever. But if do they feel the same way? A lot of times there's an imbalance in that feeling, right? So if you're just kind of sticking around to get some gratification, and this other person's feelings are actually much deeper than yours are, I feel like that's definitely breaking this precept. Paulette?
Sorry. I was going to say, when we were talking about this before, like using your position to like impose sexuality on another person. Mm. And there was something else, and I don't remember what it was. That's it.
I wonder also about basically making all of our choices, or most of our choices, about which people to interact with, which people to spend our time on, etc., based on their level of attractiveness. Whether that is physical or sexual or just, you know, charismatic and how they make you feel or something. But I guess this ties in a little bit to just a sense I have personally that, I don't know what other countries are like, but that in America, a lot of times we only choose to spend time with people that we enjoy spending time with. They're funny, we have a good time, they're not a downer, you know, so in other words, there has to be some quality of them and their personality, or maybe their appearance, or who knows, which then, you know, now they're worth spending time with, which seems like a very self-centered way to judge it, as opposed to, you know, deeper things about a relationship, like over time and shared experience and commitment to each other, etc. So a lot of times, you know, friends just drift apart because, oh, he's not fun anymore. Or he lives across town and I can't be bothered to drive over to see him. So I don't know if anybody relates to that or not, but Katie.
Oh, I read this book called Dopamine Nation, and there's like a whole side of sexuality now that's online. And some of it's pretty, you know, it's just very, you know, it's can be like an addiction. And I think that maybe should go in this list, this getting addicted to sexuality. Mm.
And there you go with our like overlapping precepts, right? Because we have one coming up on you know, not indulging in intoxication, and this definitely can be one of them. And I think also our building our sense of self-worth on our attractiveness and this is especially true for women physically. I mean, from the time, I mean, just the fairy stories you read as a child, if there is a female character in as the first sentence, it will tell you how she looks. Is she beautiful? Usually if she rates being in the story at all, she's beautiful. If she's evil, she's probably ugly. So they'll mention that. Or plain, you know, kind of those women that sit around the edges, they don't even really matter. So, you know, this is something that's just drilled into women from day one. But, you know, that's not the only kind of attractiveness. I mean, we just have to look at the primate world, right? The males have to go out there and they have to do their thing in order to attract mates. It's a different thing. But, you know, so I know that it can be just as difficult for men who aren't tall, aren't wealthy, aren't assertive, who don't have status, you know, and then what are you? Then, you know, it's very, very, very difficult. So I don't know, I guess that in that sense, maybe we, you know, we're breaking the precept, but we're hurting ourselves.
I guess I have two things to kind of add to that. The first being that in general, I think the way that society has changed in the past 10 years or 20 years and the way we experience it has, especially because of the internet, has to do with more of what we consider the superficial, more strictly physical aspects of what you call attraction, intimacy, or sexuality, right? So the way we experience that is that, like, these qualities matter more, they're more valued. We spend more time on the internet, so, like, we experience those things as being more important. So I think just that's a comment, but I think the other aspect has to do with the self. And, you know, we're talking a lot about intimacy with others, but then there's the aspect about being intimate with oneself and not, like, just necessarily in, like, just the sexual way, but, like, a sense of emotional vulnerability with oneself, right? I don't know. And I think that's overlooked, and, like, just to accept one's own emotional state or needs, and that sometimes are not fulfilled, and that's just what it is.
Yeah,
you know.
Thank you, Tyler.
Yeah, I think this has probably been touched on a little bit, but just not using intimacy as, or not seeing intimacy as having then ownership over something or someone. Yeah, and so not using it as a way of ownership or control over someone. Well, that was just something we've kind of talked about. You talked about the conquest a bit in there, but, and there's some other things with power, but yeah, just not seeing it as a, not using it as a tool of control or ownership over. Yeah,
you really make me think of and I mean, usually when we're talking about the precepts, we should be reflecting on ourselves and not on, like, the bad things that other people do. but there's a certain kind of, it comes off as social charisma that, I mean, I don't have, so I can't really break the precept in this way. But I think you'll know what I'm talking about. It's somebody who's really good at, like, very quickly making you feel like you and they have something special. Like, really, like, and they, but they do that, they're able to do that with everyone. Mm-hmm. Everyone. And so everyone around them, like, adores them because they get this kind of warmth and admiration from them. But it's almost like they're giving it out so indiscriminately that it really doesn't mean anything at all. Like, you don't really have a special relationship with this person. They've just somehow managed to make you feel that way. And I mean, there are people out there who are just like genuinely sweet and warm and are just showering this in it. But there's, in some instances, it also comes with a tendency to manipulate people. You know, once they've got people like that, just like, would you do something for me? You know, and I found myself as well, like drawn toward people like that. And then I always get very, very suspicious early on. I'm thinking of that as intimacy as a tool of control.
Yeah, it's just I find that happens with certain men towards me who probably are significantly cooler or whatever than I've ever been. But I can tell when they're all of a sudden they're interacting with me in a certain way where they're trying to draw, you know, like, oh yeah, like you're just like me. And I'm like, we haven't been in the, but there's usually something they want out of it. They're trying to sell me something or something. Cause like, we're not usually friends, but okay, here we go. And then it turns out they want something.
Oh boy. Yeah. So this gets subtle. I want to share a little bit at the end here with what Clark has to say about real intimacy. And this is actually a friend of his. So he has had this long dialogue with a friend. I think the friend's also a monk. And so his friend says, I know a moment of intimacy has been reached when I am no longer preoccupied by concern about the other person's judgment or critique of what I share. Ironically, a moment of intimacy occurs when I have been with a person long enough to discover that there are differences between us. In intimacy, I never want to harm, manipulate, or try to convince someone of anything beyond what I believe is good for that person. In this moment of time, no other preoccupation or person is as important as you and your well-being. There is an unself-conscious realization that after this time, other people and other concerns will preoccupy both of us. And that realization contributes to the giving process. A moment of intimacy occurs when the goal of life's deepest pursuit is surprisingly met. But having reached that goal, the moment remains intimate only with the willingness on the part of each to surrender what has been achieved. And I think this ties into the second phrase after our precept, the three wheels are pure and clear. So the three wheels are giver, receiver, and gift. Pure and clear. When you have nothing to desire, we follow the way of all Buddhas. So in true intimacy, there's not a sense of separation that leads to passionate longing, to intoxication, to a desire to possess, to control, to hold on, to have it look in some particular way. Like I longed for intimacy with my father because I like to talk about deep stuff. That is my favorite thing to do with people. And that didn't happen. That just didn't happen. Like, we didn't really talk much at all. And I had this sense of sadness, but at some point, I can't remember what it was, but I recognized that just that is not how the intimacy was going to look with my father. The love was there. He was never going to look at me and go, "I love you so much, come here, give me a big hug." But his support of me over the years, our ability to do an activity together, just enjoy each other's company quietly, I realized, when we get ourselves out of the way and our neediness and our expectation, there's a, it's like there's intimacy all over the place, just waiting for us. Our sense of self becomes more permeable. And that intimacy, like Clark's friend was saying, is just, it's not something that we have to own or hold. It doesn't have to belong to us. It's something that even something as apparently semi-permanent as a, romantic relationship is still like, it's still impermanent, right? We're still just enjoying this person right now. Things change. Things will eventually end. So then Clark talks about just how he felt after having done a lot of work on this issue. He said, "The new freedom is strange and uncomfortable at first. The monument I built to my own neediness does not disappear, but uncovered at last, it is no longer an idol demanding homage. It stands now as a silent reminder of a former bondage to which part of me will always be inclined to return. But now I am free to choose to care for others because they need care, not just because I need to care for them. To engage others because they too feel disconnected, not just because I feel that way. Even to forgive parents while seeing even more clearly their failures. Now I can leave others free to receive or reject the care I offer. Having unmasked my own idol, I am less tempted to refashion others into my own image of who they should be, and I'm less demanding that they respond to me as I anticipate and desire." So I will leave it there. Some wonderful Zen teaching from a Capuchin monk. All right. I offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you, everyone. Have a good evening.